can we land on the winning molecule way early? And this is not new to drug discovery. You know, we've looked from small molecules to protein and monoclonal antibody drugs. We've been doing this, we've been visualizing it, but I think right now probably we can take it to the next level.
Hey, smart biotech scientists, welcome back. We are in the middle of a conversation with Vijaya Ali, who's a strategy expert passionate about bridging the gap between research and commercialization. And we are talking about the challenges involved in developing cell and gene therapies, and then most importantly, how do we bring them to patients? So if you haven't listened to part one of our conversation, please go back and listen to that part first. And today, we are continuing our journey and asking the question, how are we making these therapies more accessible? So stay tuned for an exciting conversation. Are you juggling the complexities of CMC development while trying to enjoy the beauty of biotech? Have you ever wondered if there's a way to simplify bioprocessing? Welcome to the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast, where we're diving headfirst into the very challenges you face. We're breaking it down, demystifying the jargon, and giving you the keys to unlock your full potential. I'm your host, David Brohlman, and I get it. With 15 plus years in the biotech industry, I face the same challenges you do. There's a way to simplify and streamline so you can remove complexity, you can skip trials and errors, deliver without delay your groundbreaking therapy to clinics at market, and still enjoy every single step. Do you want to learn how industry experts and I did it? Grab a cup of coffee and your favorite notebook and pen. Now is the time to take your bioprocessing game to the next level. Let's smarten up biotech. Now let's focus on the cause, because the FDA recently approved two gene therapies to treat sickle cell anemia. And I mean, they changed the patients' lives, but the treatments are anywhere beyond 2 million or 3 million. It's just astronomical. Now the question is, how can we decrease the development and the manufacturing costs? What strategies do we have at our disposal?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, if you just take a step back and look at technology in general, like the technology goes through different phases of innovation and cost associated with it. And, you know, just case in point, I think computers were, or the first processors and servers were much more expensive in the early days in the 70s and 60s, what they are now relative to the cost. And even if you look at genomic sequencing, et cetera, and those panels were much more expensive. I guess there is one, economies of scale, if you can call it, or like a cycle in the development. And going back to the first point, like there are more countries, there's more innovation happening, and you could actually get to produce these therapies in more centers than you actually believed. I don't think we are there yet for cell and gene therapy, if I'm being honest. But I think once a critical mass is reached, then there is the thing. I think the other approach is essentially collaboration between academic centers, between different pharma companies, and I can give you some examples as well as the regulators. Without compromising on the integrity of data and the robustness of evidence that's needed for approval, I believe there are probably some inefficiencies in the system that can be smoothened out for the benefit of everybody. Like, can we collaborate more with some academic centers? And that's happening. Like, for case in point, gene therapy center of excellences were created for the first wave, and then they are being reused, or they were created in a very efficient manner and they are phased out when they are not needed, when gene therapy becomes a little bit more mainstream. In the cell therapy space also, we see the accreditation has moved beyond brands. So those are some of the ways in which you can streamline cost. But I think one of the biggest driver of cost is the cost of development. So I think data analytics, smart target selections, if you just go back to the basics of why these drugs are so costly, is because you have a high failure rate in the initial stages, and you're basically adding those failures to the cost, and that essentially drives up the actual cost of the therapy that reaches the end stage, and that's the end stage is approval, essentially. So you're coming through a broad funnel and moving into one approved therapy, and that really drives some of that cost because that is needed. If we can cut that down, by using technology, by using data-driven approaches and using the advances that we have at our disposal, perhaps that cost can be brought back. And we've been hearing about this phrase about like bed to bedside and bed back to bench, right? But I think with AI and data, the place where we are probably at an inflection point wherein you could get a bit more creative. And when I say creative, it's like, what is the implication of this data that we are seeing in this part of the ecosystem to some other part of the ecosystem? Like, can you look at patient level personal health records and say that, you know, why did certain characteristics lead to a certain outcome? And can they inform future drug development, essentially? So without really having to subject the patients or the animals through rigorous testing, maybe the models that are very highly sensitive to bring those insights are needed. And I think the other thing would probably be on pricing itself, like outcome-based pricing is something that we are seeing wherein these agreements are forged between the payers and the manufacturers and maybe even some other entities like providers or the government of certain geographies. And then essentially they can be used to reimburse in a way that is in line with the benefit that it confers. And I think I can give one good example, which is very recent, essentially, where CMS is essentially the Medicaid and Medicare payer in the US, catering to two segments of the population. One is lower socioeconomic, and second is older patients. So it's more like the government insurance, you know, very similar to NHS and others, but it only covers certain sections of the population. But they essentially came up with a outcomes-based pricing model for sickle cell disease. And the interesting thing about sickle cell disease is that it affects people of perhaps lower socioeconomic strata of the society a bit more than the other populations. So it's concentrated on lower socioeconomic. So there was a need for CMS to bring about some sort of a health equity initiative to ensure that access is not restricted and it just doesn't become a drug that lies unused for the target population. So what they have done is essentially created this around a two-year plan, which rolls out now and comes into fruition in 2025. And it starts with collaborating with the state governments in different states in the US and essentially getting them in. At the same time, collaborating with the manufacturers to set up the terms for the outcomes-based agreements. And then everyone's aligned. And based on those terms that are agreed, they are basically the therapies are rolled out. And if everyone opted in and the outcomes come in the phrase, then the cost is then determined at that point. And interestingly, when I was reading, I also realized that providers or hospitals are kind of kept out of the loop in this, which I thought was very interesting because you're looking at a system where you want to incentivize the physicians and the providers to administer care irrespective of the cost, and all of the cost negotiation is taken out of the system. So I thought that was a very good example of catering to a patient population that has high unmet need and you're kind of coming up with them. And I think there are numerous such agreements in place in the cell and gene therapy space, especially for pediatric indications as well. Like that's another area where these agreements make sense because the therapy, if given early in the life, is curative. It's innovative to a degree that you cannot even comprehend.
And if we take this a step further now, Majia, what is your perspective on making these therapies accessible to people who are in developing country? Is that realistic at all at one point, or is that just a therapy that's for the Western world?
I think if you asked me this question maybe 3 years back, I would have said, hey, hold off. Like, this is just way too complicated for any other geography. But I think there is actually a very different emerging trend that's coming about outside of the US, and two countries, Spain and India, essentially are coming about with in cell therapy space. They are coming about with, in layman's term, like home-brewed cell therapies, right? They're very localized. They are basically regulated only within a certain academic center or a cluster of academic centers. And the regulation is also modified to cater to that. That means to say this is where probably pharma and biotech models doesn't work. And I know there are some commercialization strategies which are different over there, but you're basically, the academic center is developing their own CAR T therapies and administering it to a local population, to whoever comes, which is a lighter model on many fronts because the regulation is now only based on how many patients come and how do you do the trials and approvals on that. So it's very center specific, which is a very big departure from what we see typically, which is like company specific and the patents and et cetera is all in that regard. So I think that's a very, very innovative trend that has emerged. And we are seeing so many examples of that pop up now. And I think there is great benefit because as we realize that the crux and the fulcrum is actually with the academic center, so empowering them. And I think, again, back to my point about collaboration, I would say, is there. I think beyond that, that is one example. But I think beyond that, there still needs to be something innovative on pricing and contracting because the price points are just way too high to even be subsidized in any form. One other area, which I think is like one of those, what do you say, crazy innovative ideas is maybe like some sort of innovative fund that can, you know, help cover the cost. I was interacting with someone who does parent-driven research for rare diseases. So in the rare disease community, unfortunately, a lot of children suffer from very debilitating diseases. And sometimes the parents take up ownership of developing drugs or leading on that. Then sometimes the trials are very small just because the condition is so rare. As I was speaking to someone over there, one of the ideas they brought about was like philanthropy kind of tying in. Like, you know, and if you go back to the roots of philanthropy, people like a legacy. And you see buildings of universities or statues or memorials, etc., right? These are physical objects or manifestations of legacy. But what if you could use philanthropy, create a pathway for legacy for someone to really support, right? It's not just like, hey, I click a button and donate some money, but more on the legacy front, like an endowment for these high-cost therapies, if nothing else, right? Which I thought was a crazy-ish idea today, but not that far-fetched in the digital world. And we are increasingly seeing people move away from physical world to digital world and all of that stuff. So with all of that, can we create something that incentivizes this ultra-rich population to help out the ultra-rare population?
Yeah, that's exciting. I think we definitely need some crazy ideas and we need to think of out of the box. And I'd like to circle back to the beginning of our discussion where we talked more about the science and the technical challenges, because we do have a lot of emerging technologies now at our disposal. We have AI, we have machine learning, we have amazing data analytics. Can you share with our listeners and the potential you see of just data analytics, machine learning, and how they transform the entire effectiveness and efficiency of the whole development?
I'll probably, you know, this is the area that's very close to my heart. And also, like, I'm not going to follow the chronological order of development, but go with the flow over here. So I think number one, I would say is supply chain, wherein you can actually simulate, you can visualize so much better. And as we just spoke about it, the ecosystem is fragmented, whether you take it as gene therapies or you take cell therapies, between the payers, between the prescribers, between the administrators, between the manufacturing side. There is just so much of like breaking points that patient benefit or patient welfare can fall through the cracks because you could lose patients, you could lose samples, you could lose time, which is very important over here. So I think supply chain plays a very, very important role. And if you're looking at cross-geography supply chain, if you're looking at cross-asset even, I would say, like start with plan for one, administer something else. Can we create, so I think number one, I would say where data can play a very strong role is essentially visualizing and making decisions based on what we are seeing and actually making systems efficient at the end of the day. Because the whole idea of AI is like you train the models and the models make things more smarter. As the process increases, as more patients flow through the system, what's the optimal size? Can we bring down the timelines? Can we bring down the efficiencies? Can we bring down quality issues that are emerging in this entire system? That I would say is number one. Number two, I would say is like back to the basics. Are we selecting the right targets? Because we spoke about safety being one of the drivers of cost and complexity. We spoke about how the big funnel leads to high cost. So can we land on the winning molecule way early? And this is not new to drug discovery. You know, we've looked from small molecules to protein and monoclonal antibody drugs. We've been doing this. We've been visualizing it. But I think right now, probably we can take it to the next level. I know that the construct of these therapies tends to be more complex. And with AI, perhaps we could visualize and we could come up with better solutions faster, which also leads to a better life cycle for the drug because you can get the drugs from one stage to the other faster. So you're kind of cutting down on some time and bringing them some efficiencies. Then this can be anything from the DNA level to the mRNA level to the protein level, you're basically mining a lot of data and making the system more intelligent to pick up the right targets, to have the right constructs, to bring down safety issues potentially right from the get-go. I think that I would say is number two in terms of where data can play. Number three, I think commercialization itself. Post-COVID, I think the drug commercialization has changed. The model of engagement with stakeholders has changed. We've been hearing the term omni-channel and multi-channel marketing for probably a decade plus, but COVID just gave it a push because now physicians really cut down on some face-to-face time and they're much more open to receiving information and understanding about drugs from a digital forum, which brings about that level of data. Like, can you customize your messaging, customize the information that needs to go by digital channels, you know, to ensure that physicians there. And I think one use case you can look at in commercialization is training. If a new site has to be formed or a new country where language has to be translated, previously it would have taken months to execute. And now with AI, we can really roll out these smart solutions pretty fast and capture data back on the efficiency of the solution as well. Right? I think number three, I would say, is like commercialization, launch, multi-channel marketing, digital engagement of physicians is probably another place where we could do. The fourth one I would talk about is like regulatory and innovative trial design, like pushing the envelopes a little bit in having maybe a real world control arms or creating some sort of a data-driven approach to assessing endpoints faster. We've seen that happening in other diseases as well. And I think there is openness to that. And it just really lends itself well to rare populations where you cannot essentially design trials the same way that you design for a large indication and wherein the synthetic control arms or simulated data can really add to what we are seeing. Because ultimately, you do want a drug to be fully approved, fully available to patients. I think so that's another area where I feel some envelopes can be pushed on the regulatory front, on the clinical design front. And this, again, requires collaborations between pharma companies and academic institutions and the trialists, as well as the regulators. So I think that's another place where I would say a strong role of data to ensure that the system moves forward.
Now, as we are wrapping up, Ajit, I'm curious about where you see this going, because we have a lot of on the data front, on the digitization front, on the technology and science front. Where do you see cell and gene therapy evolving to in 5 to 10 years from now?
I think number one, like going back to some crazy ideas, we know that the manufacturing is complex. We know that there are different stakeholders. Can we create like a Uber or an Airbnb model where companies very easily sort of leverage each other's capabilities? And that can also go for academic institutions. And I think the COVID vaccine production is a good case study wherein one company would have the innovative asset, they would leverage the manufacturing capacities of like from some others, and then the commercialization capacities of other companies. The system moved very fast and wherein companies started collaborating on their strengths. And we are seeing this happen in cell therapies, in gene therapies, like the center of excellence model and the creating the center of excellence and disbanding it at the right time. And also we saw Novartis invest a lot of money into their cell and gene therapy manufacturing and other companies actually leveraging it. I think other companies actually sort of took those capabilities and ensured that the supply chain shortages are met. So I think that is one wherein more collaboration between different systems, because it kind of makes the pie bigger and the patient benefits at the end of the day. So I think that's one way. And I think data plays a very strong role, as I said, like making that fragmented market or fragmented system much more cohesive. I know the Uber and Airbnb analogy sort of throws people off, but I think when you listen to it in this way, then you're like, oh yeah, there's so much that is happening. And regulators are not easy to please in terms of getting something new up and running. Right. So can we just leverage what's already there? And as the product life cycles evolve, this becomes more important. What if you have developed this innovative therapy and you don't have a patented product and you moved away from that space? Instead of selling and doing the usual M&A route of physical infrastructure, can you create more of a capability infrastructure and lease that out? I think it's happening. And for cell and gene therapy, it's very relevant. The second thing, I think smarter cell therapies and gene therapies, then even to the point of like non-gene therapy, like we're looking at allogeneic. I was reading up about cell therapy without cells, extracting non-cell material and then trying to create the same modality that a CAR-T therapy has. So I think pushing the envelopes of the constructs of these therapies itself to ensure that the complexities is reduced. I'd still say there is a bit of skepticism around it because a lot of innovative therapies have been thrown around, right from the vectors in the gene therapies to like using iPSC cells or using allogenic gamma delta. I don't know, I'm rattling off some names here, but we haven't seen that much promise that generation one cell and gene therapy have shown. So I think there's a little bit of skepticism, but I think the constructs will get smarter. And I think the third thing is, again, I think taking a step back and seeing that how can we identify patients better? Like how can we get the therapy to the right patients at the right time? So who will benefit from the therapy more? Which geography do they live in? And who is responsible for providing access? And again, I kind of go back to vaccines because I think vaccines, although it's the opposite of the spectrum, it's like mass. The volumes are big, but that's what the nonprofit organizations, the World Health Organizations and other initiatives have done. They've basically said, the disease exists in one part of the world, the science and the innovation exists in another part of the world. How can we bridge the gap? How can we get that? So I think similarly, I would say like that would really be beneficial. One area that I see is like digital twins or digital personalities, like wherein you could have patients and caregivers and champions, essentially creating a share of voice for people who would otherwise be lost without the digital world. Like you're in another geography or don't have access. And can you basically ensure that these patients' voices are heard and they get the right therapy, whether it's through a clinical trial or an expanded access or through commercialized therapy? So I think I would see a lot more of like patient community and nonprofits and the entire system existing in the digital world and ensuring that. So I think those are a few of my ideas on what we can see in the future. I don't think the field is going to be being wiped out anytime soon. It's still going to exist in a few years, but in a much more refined and advanced form than what we see over here right now.
Fantastic. It's exciting, Vijaya. So what is the 22nd takeaway from all the things we've covered today?
I think the 22nd key takeaway is that the scientific and pharma and the whole system has brought together something that is similar to science fiction to life. Now, if science fiction comes to life and it's a reality in present day, like how do we basically maximize the benefit of it? So I would say that's the thing, like bringing science fiction to life and taking it forward.
Wow, that's a great conclusion. How do we bring science fiction to life and how do we maximize it? I like that. So thank you very much, Vijaya, for sharing your thoughts, your insights. Where can people connect with you?
So I'm available on LinkedIn. I am also available on X and I can drop my credentials if there is a note. I just want to say that I really enjoy sharing my knowledge that I've gained over the last 15 plus years of my career on the platform X or Twitter. I focus on mentoring younger and mid-career folks on their career journeys. I think as we started the conversation, it's not a ladder, it's a jungle gym. Everyone's path is very different. And I think as the scientific innovation is happening, there's also a big change in the way work is being seen across industries. So I try to help people navigate the complexities of planning their careers and overcoming challenges that they have and making critical decisions. I try to share my knowledge over there and hoping to do more of that while I still continue to contribute to the scientific ecosystem. So I'm available on LinkedIn and on X, not so much on like something like a TikTok or Instagram. So you won't find me there. You'll find me more on the nerdy platforms.
I'll leave all the details down in the show notes. So please do take advantage, reach out to Vijaya. And thank you once again, Vijaya, for being on the show today.
Thank you. My pleasure. It was a pleasure sharing my knowledge. And I look forward to listening more of the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast in my free time and during my commute.
Hey, Smart Biotech Scientists. I hope you have enjoyed this conversation on the development and commercialization of cell and gene therapies. So I'm curious to know what you think about this episode. Reach out to us and let us know what you liked and also what topics you would like us to include in further episodes. So I love hearing from you. And to help you navigate the complex journey from the lab to full-scale production, we have designed a comprehensive 90-day program. And this program is tailor-made so that you can develop your therapies with peace of mind. To help you understand if this is what you need, I'm offering you a free, no-obligation assessment. So schedule your call now using the link in the show notes. All right, smart scientists. That's all for today on the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast. Thank you for tuning in and joining us on your journey to bioprocess mastery. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. By doing so, we can empower more scientists like you. For additional bioprocessing tips, visit us at smartbiotechscientist.com. Stay tuned for more inspiring biotech insights in our next episode. Until then, let's continue to smarten up biotech.